Kennedy's assassination, McNamara formally endorsed a strategy of assured destruction. The idealism and optimism that had accompanied Kennedy's inauguration were long gone. The new strategy was grounded in a sense of futility. It planned to deter a Soviet attack by threatening to wipe out at least 30% of their population, 50% of their industrial capacity, and 150 of their cities. McNamara's staff had calculated that the equivalent of 400 megatons detonated above the Soviet Union would be enough for the task. Anything more would be overkill. Informed by a reporter that the Soviets were hardening their silos to protect the missiles from an American attack, McNamara said, "Thank God." The move would improve crisis stability. Once the Soviets felt confident that they could retaliate after being attacked, they'd feel much less pressure to strike first. Leaving the cities of the United States and the Soviet Union vulnerable to annihilation, McNamara now thought, would keep them safe. The strategy was soon known as MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. The strategic thinking at the White House and the Department of Defense, however, didn't correspond to the targeting policies at SAC headquarters in Omaha. The gulf between theory and practice remained vast. Although the PSYOP had been revised during the Kennedy administration, General Power had blocked significant changes in weapon allocation. The new PSYOP divided the optimum mix into three separate target groups: Soviet nuclear forces, conventional military forces, and urban industrial areas. The president could decide to attack only the first group, the first two groups, or all three. Moscow, China, and cities in the Eastern Bloc could selectively be spared from destruction. The PSYOP could be launched as a first strike or as retaliation. But all the attack options still required that the Soviet Union be hit by thousands of nuclear weapons, far more than were necessary for assured destruction. The three target categories of the PSYOP, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, were the same as those in the attack plan proposed by SAC in 1950. And the new PSYOP was almost as destructive, inflexible, and mechanistic as the previous one. A war plan that seemed too horrible to contemplate when Kennedy and McNamara first learned of its existence had become institutionalized. By the time Robert McNamara retired from the Pentagon in February 1968, the command and control system of the United States had been improved. The new missile defense alarm system, satellites with infrared sensors that could detect heat from the launch of missiles, promised to give as much as half an hour of warning if the Soviets attacked. SAC's Looking Glass command post, airborne 24 hours a day, increased the likelihood that a go code could be sent after the United States was hit. New computer and communication systems were being added to the worldwide military command and control system, but many of the underlying problems hadn't been solved. The number of nuclear weapons in the American arsenal had increased by more than 50% since the Eisenhower administration. The United States now had about 30,000 of them, and each one could potentially be lost, stolen, sabotaged, or involved in an accident. Tactical weapons hadn't been removed from Europe. On the contrary, the number of tactical weapons had more than doubled, and they were no longer safely tucked away in igloos. Putting locks in NATO's weapons allowed them to be widely dispersed to units in the field, where they could be more easily stolen. And the question of how to keep the president alive and in command still didn't have a satisfactory answer. The plans for a deep underground command center were scrapped after Kennedy's death. The bunker had a good chance of surviving multiple hits from Soviet warheads, but its survival would prove meaningless. After an attack, the president and his aides would most likely find themselves trapped 2/3 of a mile beneath the rubble of the Pentagon, unable to communicate with the rest of the world or even get out of their bunker. The facility would serve primarily as a multi-million-dollar tomb. Although McNamara's efforts to avoid a nuclear war were tireless and sincere, he left office as one of the most despised men in the United States. 500,000 American soldiers were fighting in Vietnam. The war seemed unwinnable, and most Americans blamed the number-crunching Secretary of Defense and his Ivy League advisors for the fiasco. A centralized command and control system, so essential for managing a nuclear war, had proven disastrous when applied to a civil war in Southeast Asia. Distrusting the Joint Chiefs of Staff and convinced that victories on the battlefield could be gained through cost-benefit analysis, the Secretary of Defense micromanaged the Vietnam War. McNamara personally chose targets to be bombed and supervised airstrikes from his office at the Pentagon. "I don't object to its being called McNamara's War," he said in 1964. "In fact, I'm proud to be identified with it." 4 years later, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese civilians had been killed. Tens of thousands of American servicemen had been killed or wounded. Anti-war protests were spreading throughout the United States, and the Pentagon had become a symbol of bureaucratic malevolence and pointless slaughter. Known for his cool, detached manner, McNamara was now prone to bouts of sobbing in his office. While receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom the day before his retirement, he apologized for being unable to speak. President Lyndon Johnson put a hand on McNamara's shoulder, ended the ceremony, and guided him from the room. Curtis LeMay withdrew from public life the same year, having left the Air Force in 1965. Once the darling of Hollywood and the media, he was now widely mocked and ridiculed. His well-publicized disputes with the Kennedy administration had given him a reputation for being a right-wing Neanderthal. When a fictionalized version of General LeMay appeared in film, the character was no longer a heroic defender of freedom. He was a buffoon, like General Buck Turgidson in Dr. Strangelove, willing to sacrifice 20 million American lives for the sake of defeating the Soviet Union. Or he was a crypto-fascist, like General James Mattoon Scott in 7 Days in May, preferring a coup d'etat in the United States to a disarmament treaty with the Soviets. LeMay seemed to confirm those stereotypes in October 1968, when he agreed to serve as the vice presidential candidate for the American Independent Party. George C. Wallace, an outspoken racist and segregationist, was the presidential candidate. LeMay had played a leading role in integrating the Air Force, and his support for equal rights, labor unions, birth control, and abortion seemed out of place in the Wallace campaign. But LeMay's anger at how the Vietnam War was being fought, and his belief that both